Good morning. Can everyone hear me okay? Well, thank you very much, Mindy, and I thank FTX for giving me the opportunity to moderate this panel. For those of you who know Les and Larry, or maybe some of you don't know Les and Larry, they, as evidenced by what Mindy said, have tremendous experience and have been an extremely valuable discussion and interaction by one of the calls I had with them. I think to myself, and I said to them, it's really going to be my challenge. It's like a facilitator facilitating facilitators. Now, who can say that three quite quickly? We all can say that. So I believe that what's going to happen is I'm going to ask one open-ended question, and then I'll close it at the end. So our ground rules, shall we have ground rules, even though these ground rules are probably going to be dug underground in about 2 seconds, but the ground rules are that we really are trying to have interactive discussion. So only rule I have is that I reserve the right to have to cut either one of you off if necessary, so just to keep us on track, my personal challenge. And also what we've done is we've carved out about 15 minutes to the end of this of the discussion for questions. So if you would hold your questions, that would be great. If during this, the course of the discussion something is triggered for you, make a note so that you don't forget, because I know we all have very short memories these days with all that's going on. So that when it comes to the end, some of you will have some questions to ask. So without further ado, I'm going to start with my first open-ended question and then sit down. Okay. So, Larry and Les, we've talked a little bit about what successes, you know, you've had and what you've seen with boards and their members and how those kinds of successes have impacted exit strategies and companies. So could you give us a little bit of your perspective in terms of, you know, what kind of solid perspectives you've seen that have made boards really strong?
You want to start, Les?
No, go ahead.
And I'll come in at the question.
All right.
3 minutes.
Oh, God. I have to confess, I have worked with a number of family business on exit issues. There have been many times that I've recommended a board, and they've never taken the advice. I still think it's good advice to take. Let me go off on a completely different tangent, which is exactly what Hollis predicted. Let me first talk to the people in the audience who are not owners of businesses, but professional service providers. How many professional service providers? All right, so it's just us girls talking, okay? This is not about the clients, it's about you. And why would you be an advocate for recommending a board of directors or board of advisors, and we'll get into that, even if it's very likely the CEO may not accept that recommendation? How many of you would like to position yourselves as being valued advisors to your clients? And how many of you find your clients really don't want you as value advisors? They want you as narrowly focused transactional people. How many of you find that? Okay. One of the issues is, let's look at what's going on at Goldman Sachs. I actually videotaped the testimony, and I actually watched it. And I thought the senators' questions were pretty reasonable. And I came away from that testimony saying, you know, probably Goldman Sachs hasn't done anything illegally wrong. And Goldman Sachs probably hasn't done anything that other financial institutions haven't done. Having said that, Goldman Sachs has reinforced every fear that your clients have about you. Which is, you go to say to your clients, I'm really covering your back. My interests are your interests. You know, you can trust me. And the client is smiling at you and saying, bullshit. You're interested in yourself. You're interested in your firm. I am merely a meal ticket for you. And what goes on in Goldman Sachs hasn't created anything new. It's reinforced every fear that every client has about everybody in this room. And so, to deal with the Goldman Sachs issues and the prevailing fears, how are you going to do that? And I find that coming to clients and talking about boards and the necessity to create boards, and you know, sometimes, frankly, I hope that they say, and I'd like you to be on my board of advisors too. It does a number of things. It is purely in their interests, and you can convince them why it is in their interests. It also, if you get onto a board of advisors of a client, it transforms the relationship that you have from a transactional focused one to one of a long-term valued advisor. And then there's a third reason. There are certain very sensitive topics that are sort of like the third rails of a relationship with a client. Those topics may involve the competence of the son or daughter to take over the business. It may involve the competence of the CEO to continue to manage the business. It may involve kind of the family dynamics. When is it time to sell? Sometimes these difficult conversations are best done instead of, I think this, it's we as a board think this. So there are times when these difficult conversations are best done as a group. Now, there are lots of very good reasons why an owner would want to have a board, but I'm just addressing the first one about why you would want to make the suggestion about creating a board, even though it's very likely that the CEO is going to reject that suggestion.
Okay, so Les?
I'm going to try to answer the first question.
damn you!
I think you said, where can the board be helpful and what experiences we've had? So I'd like to list two that I've been through. One is in the process where it's a board of directors where the CEO has not had the experience of having a liquidity event, which is my experience most of them. They're not multiple-time entrepreneurs, in fact, who have been through the process. And so the value of the board has been to get, number one, the company prepared, but more importantly, to get the entrepreneur prepared to go through the process. I know enough of you in the audience to know you've been through your first time once, and it's a difficult process. And the board's experience comes to bear. Let me give one specific example. Number one, Mary and I were talking about this earlier. It's just the whole issue of preparing for the warranties and represent clause. You don't know what's going to be in there. That might get in the way of the deal, and an experienced board gets you there. Example two, where a company down the street from here had an extraordinarily experienced board in the industry sector, totally well recognized, better recognized than the company itself. That by itself brought in unsolicited offers from large international companies because they looked and said, if these people are on the board, they have total vertical knowledge. And the value of the company was, as it actually turned out 50% higher than anybody thought. And after the transaction was over a drink, which is always a good place to do it, everybody agreed it was the board members that caused that. Not because they were at the table negotiating, but because they were there, and they weren't just there 3 months before the company might have thought about a liquidity event, but over the last year and a half and 2 years. So there are two examples.
The two examples that I will give is... many of my clients who are owners of businesses, when they were students, they were the kind that always put off the things they didn't want to do to the very last minute, and they would only do it under pressure. You know, they would be the ones who wouldn't study for the final until the night before the final, and then
you're supposed to do it before that.
Yeah, right. and I've had comments from my clients that I hated the fact that my board forced me to put a strategic plan together, held my feet to the fire to do it. And I'm so grateful that they did it because I wouldn't have done it by my own. Some people just need the structure of you have to do this, and you have to do this on a certain date. And they resent it and need it and value it. The second issue with a board is if you structure your board correctly, you can leverage the marketing and sales opportunities. And I've certainly have seen this in my own experience where I've been on a board, and because of the contacts that I have, my contacts are more at the CEO level, and so I can get it at a higher level than a salesperson, and then get them dropped down in an organization. And particularly for some startups or companies trying to get into new markets, having boards with the right contacts and networks can be invaluable in terms of getting in at a much higher level than a salesperson could do.
So we've talked a little bit about at the top and the whole idea of having boards and the value of boards, but when you look right now at seeing what's going on in the economy, we hope it's starting to improve, and companies are increasing value, and that's their ultimate objective. What are the kinds of issues that you see happening out there that are really increasing kind of the value of boards and the types of boards that companies want to develop?
I'll take a shot at it. Yeah, I go back to October 2008. I'm sorry to bring us all back to that month. I think you all remember what was going on at that moment. The show that I saw, I happened to have had 4 board meetings in 9 days at that period of time, October 7th, I'll never forget. And these companies all had boards and had been through the 2001 and 2002 downside because they had the boards. That meeting in October was, agenda changed, here's the new plan. You didn't have to teach them again because they knew the plan. And many of them survived, I believe, because there was this board and this structure that you talked about, where the board and the CEO had been through the process before. The layoff plans were done October 7th, October 8th. Never would have happened without the existence of a board meeting. It was quite an incredible experience, proving what I've been trying to say for a long time, as you have. Boards are important, but that period of time really drove it home for me.
Yeah, I would, you know, I'm not sure that the economic times, to me, are the big issue. There was a study that was done several years ago at Stanford University, and as you know, as everybody in this room knows, when you do a merger, the probability of failure is something like 70%. It's very rare that it actually works out. And Stanford's study was actually looking at the private investment habits of CEOs of large companies. And it turns out that CEOs of large companies, when they are doing acquisitions, they start investing in their own companies right before the acquisitions. Because, as Warren Buffett once said, all CEOs believe that they are the prince that will turn the frog into the princess, because their kiss is worth so much more. And of course, it's not. So, I mean, one of the great things about CEOs is that they have a tremendous self-confidence. And one of the problems that CEOs have is they have tremendous self-confidence. And it's the historical role of the board to give a CEO a loving dope slap that a professional service provider often just cannot do. And it's that dope slap reality that is what makes boards so special.
Hollis, may I add another to this point about what the economy is doing? I've at least seen from where I'm sitting that companies are now flattened out. The revenues come back to some extent. But I'm seeing now CEOs looking out 1 or 2 years and beginning to rethink about the M&A process. Most of the companies that I'm on the board of will be sellers ultimately. And they're now starting to ask the questions, what do I have to do? So if you're asking me what's going on at this point, that's my vision, and those are both venture-backed companies and privately held family businesses. They're seeing the pickup a little bit, and are beginning to get themselves ready.
And I'll take it from the other extreme. We have 2 new clients. One is $2 billion New York Stock Exchange company. The other is a $2.5 billion New York Stock Exchange company. The issue that I'm finding when as I'm going to my clients is no longer as it was a year ago, you know, how do we get rid of our employees? Now it's how do we keep the most valued employees that we have? Because we recognize that during the recession we screwed them, and many of them are angry. And so how do we keep and motivate the best ones? One sub-question on this is about CEO succession. And the CEOs that I'm getting, it's the same issue. Somebody's around 61, 62, 63. They're saying they want to retire in 2, 3, or 4 years. They would really think it would be a capstone of their career if the board selected one or two of their chosen successors from internally. They also think it would create problems for investors, it would create problems for vendors, it would create problems for customers and employees if the board went outside and recruited somebody from outside the company. Then they were told by the nominating and governance committee, you know, governance has become so complicated, we don't want to hire anybody to be the CEO of this company unless they've had board experience. And so we're tasked to work with the high potential executives that might be the next CEOs and get them on boards of companies. So they get they get more board experience. So what I'm seeing at the beginning, what I'm seeing at sort of the largest companies is sort of a recognition that we want to try to load the dice in favor of internal hires. Two, we need to give these people some board experience so that when one of them becomes CEO, they've already had that experience.
So Les, what are you seeing in terms of the entrepreneurial people in this room and the privately held companies that they're, you know, advising to? What are you seeing in terms of what Larry said about that level of...
Well, I think he's totally correct. This issue now is we're flattening out and coming back a little bit. People are, as they do at the bottom of every cycle, they start. Employees start to jump around. Whether you think you've screwed them or not, I'll leave that description aside. But that typically happens. Most of us here have been through more than one cycle. And if you go back to 2002, 94, 88, at that point in the cycle, employees started to move around. The C-suite employees started to move around. So the boards that we're on are now looking at what kind of different incentive plans, not the traditional ones, which can drive people to have to stay. For example, we're putting in rolling bonus plans so that this year's bonus doesn't get paid out for the next 2 years. As a way to put real economic golden handcuffs. There's been some, in privately held companies, the value of stock options or phantom options are suspect at the moment, as it is always at this part of the cycle. So I think the board's role is to bring that experience to bear to get ahead of this cycle, because if the economy keeps going, I can't tell you whether that's true, but if it does, the turnover in the C-suite is going to be about 50% that I can see.
So to that point, what are people looking for, a different kind of profile in terms of the types of people they're bringing onto these private boards than they have in the past?
I think in your world, there's really two kinds of boards. There's boards of directors and boards of advisors. And it's important to differentiate between those two roles. A board of directors has fiduciary responsibility. Also, when you're looking at boards of directors, any potential board candidate with an IQ of over 85, their second question is going to be, do you have appropriate D&O insurance? And then a number of their attorneys will tell, you want a what? Why would you put yourself in that kind of risk? Boards of, and then there's the whole issue from your client's point of view, and that is, why would I even want a hint of losing control, even if they own 100%, just the whole issue about a board of directors and reporting to somebody, that's not what I got into business about. Board of advisors is a different kettle of fish, and that is, there is no fiduciary responsibility, you're not required to see the financials, although CEO can provide them for you. And my feeling is that it's in this market at this particular time, with everybody so concerned about their reputation and risk, it may be easier to put together a great board of advisors than a board of directors. There's some material I have out there on the table. One is a model board of directors job description, and the other is a model board of advisors job description. And so if you're going to be advising your client companies, I think the easiest way to go and get started in this whole area is a board of advisors rather than a board of directors. It's a different kettle of fish.
Well, we knew we were going to have this fight,
okay.
So let's have it now.
Actually, ask the question.
My perspective of only being on a couple hundred million dollar number boards, that size, mostly privately held, this is a distinction without a great deal of meaning for people on the board, in my opinion. Let me give you some reasons. First of all, to the extent you have a CEO, family, whatever, worried about control, this whole idea of having a board is off the table. They won't do it. You have to provide the advice of how to put a board, all the advisors and all your records together that doesn't deal with that threat. For example, I go on privately held boards, we get my resignation letter signed on the day I start. Monday. Because I want to deal with the issue of what you raise, which is control. So that's number one. Number two, for those of you who are recommending either board of advisors or boards of directors, the CEOs ought to be told, you show the financials to both of them. If you're not, and nobody should go on a board of advisors, in my opinion, that's a technical board, without being able to see the financial statements. You can't give good advice without it. So I don't think there's a particularly big difference. And second, I don't see CEOs, to the extent they're going to worry about control or being outvoted, they're not going to do either. And my last statement is, I've been on a lot of boards for a long time, with many of you, as a matter of fact. I don't remember a vote ever having been taken place on private boards. Votes don't take place. And so this whole idea of governance and nominating, I think it's inappropriate for the kinds of companies I'm describing.
Yeah, and in my experience, often it's getting involved in crisis kinds of issues, and there are votes. So I've had different experience. I also totally agree, and I totally believe that if you're ever asked to serve on board of directors or board of advisors, absolutely, write out your resignation letter, sign it, leave it undated, and say, here's your copy, but I'm also got a copy. The very moment you think I'm not providing value, I want you to date the letter, give it to me, I'm out of here. But also, the very moment that I feel I'm wasting my time, I'm going to date my letter and give it to you. If you don't do that very technique, you will never be taken seriously. Because good CEOs know how to co-opt their professional service providers.
So how many people are having challenges getting their clients to really develop a board for a board of advisors? Just one, honestly? And how many of you have board of advisors and boards and they themselves can be a challenge? Oh, none of you. You're all.
How many of you are on boards and finding a challenge?
Yeah.
Okay.
And how many are finding it a challenge? Okay. So, can you give us your best practices about how to best manage those kinds of what kinds of challenges? Perhaps somebody give me an example of a challenge.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think one of the issues is as a board member, you see yourself as a supporter of strategy, and often the strategy is someplace else and it's not transparent and you end up being a yes or no or an orderly and you get marginal on it. And that's the situation that I'm facing now. And we just did our annual evaluation. They said, how great did you think you were on creating strategy? And I go back and I said, not at all. We had no role in creating strategy. We were just yes or no.
Is this a profit or non-profit, public or private?
Not for profit.
Okay.
So let me talk to the strategy question, if I might. there's a lot of research on this issue. When you ask directors and if you ask CEOs about how they like each other's participation in developing strategy, both are dissatisfied. Both the directors, and McKinsey has done a lot of work on this area, as they would have naturally, being a strategy company. And both sides are particularly unhappy. So best practices, in my opinion, is in what way is the board involved in the development of strategy? Most times the practice is you get the strategic statement and everybody says yes, because at that point a no vote is a no against the CEO, so nobody does it. That's a very inefficient, unhelpful way for boards to be involved. My methodology for helping develop strategy is you have to be at the breakout sessions. And I don't mean to go away to the nice place and play golf for the half a day. But if there are three divisions, board members should divide themselves among the divisions and listen to the discussion all the way through. Not change, but listen and get educated, not by the CEO only, by what's going on. If you don't do that, you're a rubber stamp. And if you allow that process, you should be a rubber stamp. That's just with best practice, in my opinion.
My view is the person who sets the agenda controls the board. And often that's going to be the CEO. And often the CEO doesn't really want to... The CEO wants the board to approve the strategy, not necessarily review the strategy. And so it's not necessarily going to be featured on the agenda or just done on a half-assed way. Or the CEO is going to present a tactical plan and call it a strategic plan. It's your role as a board member to sort of say, we've got very few responsibilities as a board, and one of them is to review and approve the strategic plan. And there ought to be, once a year, 1 hour scheduled a year in advance when the board is going to do nothing but talk about strategy and review the strategy. And that it should be put on the board agenda, it should be put a year in advance, it should be insisted on it. And if you don't insist on it, then the CEO will decide what's on the strategy. Whoever sets the strategy controls the board. Whoever sets the agenda controls the board. You've got to exercise your responsibility as a board member to say, it's going to be on the agenda. We're going to spend an hour doing nothing but that, and we're really going to be talking about strategy, not your tactical plans.
Which is why you have to have an outside facilitator.
Absolutely. No, this, at a board level, you do not want an outside facilitator. Because if the board can't communicate among itself, then it's dysfunctional from the first place. So let me talk. I'm sorry, I really do feel strongly about this issue.
I guess, but you know what? Facilitation is not just in the board, but it's helping them get to the point of putting the structure so that they can have productive board meetings.
I agree with that.
So it's bottom up, top down, in the middle.
One other best practice I think is important, and it deals with what you were just talking about, is what role does the board have in setting the agenda? Even a privately held company's own, 100%. So where control is not an issue, power is not the issue. Even in those boards, there ought to be this idea that you've just put out, this pre-structured when things are going to be done. Because for me, I believe, let's just take strategy.
You're agreeing with this?
Well, not quite.
Oh, okay.
Strategy ought to be, if you're going to have the strategy meeting for a calendar year company in December, okay, you already know you've been marginalized. If you're going to have a strategy session after a company has had a breakout to already figure it out, you've been marginalized. So this idea of doing it a year in advance is totally correct, but it has to be sequential to the strategic process, whichever. And by the way, small companies are still doing. They may not do strategy statements and mission statements and a lot of other things, but they're certainly working on, in the last 8 years, about strategy. They've got that in mind. And your idea about having everything sequenced One other best practice, in my opinion, again, I'm talking privately owned businesses. Throughout the year, one of the C-suite executives ought to be at every board meeting. That allows the board to really help the CEO, in my case, CEO owners, to get another outside sense of the people who are helping them drive their own value creation. If you don't see them, everything you're doing is through the CEO's eyes. And if that's the kind of board the CEO wants, I'm suggesting you resign. You're not helping. You see everything through the CEO's filter, if you will. Even if it's not trying to hide anything. Not if it's about power, because when an owner owns 100%, that's a given already. So, yes, but I want to build out this issue about the year in advance calendar. Mm-hmm. With a whole sequence of things. That way you get a sense of it.
And let me say yes, but, to what you just said. In general, I agree, it's a very good idea for the board to kind of get a sense of the people in the C-suite. Having them involved in some parts of the meeting is a good idea, but not the whole meeting. Just a little anecdote. I was involved with a well-known defense company, and the people on the board, it would included former CIA directors, governors, and more generals and admirals than you could stick a shirk at. And the CEO really believed in bringing in his VPs into the meeting so that they could have a sense of his staff. And also, if there was a question about, let's say, HR, he would then turn to his HR person and say, well, what do you think? It turned out that when we were doing a board self-evaluation, we were talking to these admirals and generals and CIA people. They come from a strong military tradition. You never dress down a superior in front of the subordinates. And so what was happening is that the meetings had become show and tell sessions, and everything was very polite when they didn't feel that way. And once it was brought to the CEO's attention, he said, that's not what I would have in mind. And so he changed the practice. And so they would see subordinates some of the times, but not some of the other times. Let me go back to the agenda issue as a controlling mechanism. Here, how many of you've been on boards. How many of you have found this? The beginning of the meeting is taken up with basically administrative kind of stuff. And it's basically a show-and-tell session. And then about 4 o'clock on the second day of the meeting, when everybody is kind of worried about, you know, their airline flights, that's when the bomb hits. How many of you have had that experience? Okay.
You know, if we go on, I think that's a really positive vote just now. Most of you have not had that recently. That's very positive.
I think that is positive. I see that more often, and it's a controlling mechanism, and again, it looks at the agenda. If you're on boards, look at the agenda. Are the difficult questions being raised at the front end or the back end? Is the administrative stuff being done at the front end or the back end? You know, so CEOs will use the agenda setting mechanism as a control mechanism.
What other issues, John, you were going
to... I served on the Board of Advisors. I'm happy to hear you draw the distinction between the Board of Advisors and the boards. And we had a diverse set of people who specialized in finance, marketing, and other kinds of things. Okay. One of the things that I found that we installed, in addition to strategy, was also implementation and execution. Because invariably, smaller-sized companies, the smaller you get, the less likely they're going to execute. I mean, it goes right to the top as well, as we've seen. But certainly, so we wanted to hold the executive's feet to the fire relative to, okay, do you agree with what we're advising you on? And then he would say yes, and okay, so what's going to be done about it? And he'd say, I'm going to do this, 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 and the next question was, by when? So he knew up front that the next time we got together, either formally or informally, we had conference calls and then periodically we got together for face-to-face meetings, which he knew we were going to be asking very specific questions that were rooted in a certain implementation of a certain strategy. I'm just curious as to your thoughts on it. So there's a strategy, but there's also a tactical.
Yeah, but this gets back to what I was saying at the beginning, that there are some CEOs who are great CEOs, ethical CEOs, do want to do the right thing, But as students, they just wouldn't study until the very last minute and until they saw the timeline. It's time that was the key force, not intentions. You know, if the world was governed by good intentions, we would all be wealthy, but it's not. And there are some CEOs, great CEOs, well-meaning CEOs, they're not going to get around doing it until they have a deadline in their face. And part of the role of the board is to say, you're going to do it by when? And we're going to have another meeting in 6 weeks. And the first thing on the agenda is not going to be a review of the minutes, but we're going to ask you, what have you done the last 6 weeks? And they resent the hell out of you and then appreciate you at the same time.
We found just the following comment, just a real quick one, and it helped us as a board to continue to monitor the value we were bringing to the table. Mm-hmm. As he began to slip things and forget things and that sort of stuff, we realized we were becoming more and more marginalized as a board.
So I need to talk to this word marginalized. In the last 5 years, I've developed a new strategy as a director about being marginalized. Resign. Your time is valuable to you, even if you're trying to do a good help for a company. Changing CEOs' behavior is extraordinarily difficult. And so the only way that I found that's effective both for them and for me is to just resign. Not threaten, but when you're seeing yourself marginalized, don't stay around. You're not helping you, and you're not helping the company. And I'm not trying to do a power play. I'm not even suggesting you be renegotiated about staying on the board. You have to make your message. Second point about resignation. One of the best practices, in my opinion, is you all should adopt and be recommending your companies adopt director self-directed termination time, term limits. Companies haven't been doing it. We as directors, and since most of you raised your hand, pick a time frame and resign. That forces somebody who's going to have a board to get a really vital board. Or if there are 5 members, every year there's somebody going on and off the board. So you keep the old and some part of the new, which is what recreates strength on a board. So that's a best practice, in my opinion.
Can you give us an example of how you might structure timing?
Sure. My opinion is someplace between 42 and 60 months. Now, remember, I'm talking about middle-sized businesses, generally owner-manager-controlled, revenue being whatever they are. Frankly, I think for venture capital-backed companies, it should work exactly the same way.
For everybody on the board, all board members.
Everybody on the board should rotate. Now, when you start the process, you don't want everybody resigning at the same time. But once you're on the process, what makes a board work, best practices, is somebody new is there to talk about all the ideas, oh, we've discussed that before, let's not discuss it again. That's a killer for a board. I sat and watched a board observation, been together 9 years. There was no possibility of getting change on the board. You know some of the directors, as a matter of fact. So that's something I'm suggesting you all adopt for yourselves. Resign yourself at a given point in time and tell the CEO that's what you're doing up front. Don't make it a surprise or a threat.
But also, as a recruiter, you will get a better class of board members if part of it includes term limits. Because, you know, the better qualified people are always thinking about, how do I gracefully get out of here if it doesn't work? Because I didn't come to this breakfast. I didn't know that you're supposed to resign or have a letter. How do I gracefully leave if I don't like it here? So having term limit actually attracts better people.
That's what the company should have. I'm suggesting that the directors adopt that policy. Don't wait for your companies to do it. It's much better.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, people make their best contributions to the board probably in the first 12 to 24 months.
Let me ask, prior to getting to that either or, maybe the stuck position of the resignation, the composition, the selection of an effective board and a proactive planning from the chairman down, can you speak to you guys a little bit of the steps of the efficacy of a well-functioning board, presenting it, and maybe the CEO gets it or doesn't get it? applied to that, but the strategy of the board to be most effective.
Well, I'm sure we may or may not agree. We actually haven't discussed this ahead of time. For me, the issue is, if you have, let's take a five-person board and three people who don't talk on the board, have you ever been to a meeting where three people don't talk and it's dominated by two people? That's when you start to have the discussion with the CEO what it takes to have a well-functioning board. Because if the CEO only wants to hear about on phone calls, one-to-one, there's no sense having a board. You can have lunch with people. The purpose of a well-functioning board is to have dialogue, not that you have to agree. Owner-manager control's not the issue. And that's what makes a well-functioning board, if you have different perspectives where there's disagreement. Where there's disagreement, because the CEO is learning from the disagreement. And different, we might call it politely, different points of view. I'm saying it my way, it's disagreement. So that, to me, is where you stop the discussion.
If I understand your question, how do you structure a board?
So that it's most effective.
Okay.
We're running this to, again, make sure the boards, if they have two members that are not speaking to the others, who's doing...
Here's a framework that I use that helps me. Is the board's focus mostly on accomplishment of a task, or is the board's focus on the accomplishment of helping the CEO do a better job of problem solving? Now, that's not a trivial issue. If you get into things like a credit union, the strategic opportunities for doing things differently are very limited. They're limited by law. If you're looking at a human service nonprofit, the strategic opportunities for doing things different are just limited by finances. And so the focus is going to be much more on the task side. If it's a task-oriented board, we need to get it done, we need to raise money, we need to review and approve loans, you probably want to get people who think alike, who come from similar backgrounds. And so, you know, I know what Les is going to say before Les says it. And we can really move along and have a lot of esprit de corps, play a lot of golf together, really bond together, and it's going to be a nice experience. On the other hand, if it's a real problem-solving board, in other words, we have some strategic options. The CEO has got us on a course of doing A. Is A really the best way for us to be doing that? We need to be thinking outside the box. Then you really want to staff the board for diversity of opinions, diversity of perspectives. Not necessarily a very comfortable board, but there's going to be a lot of give and take and a lot of conflict. A lot of CEOs would rather have a task-oriented board where everybody's thinking the same way I do. And that may not be in the CEO's or the investor's best interest to move it in this way.
Well, that's a couple of things. I've seen some hands go up, so we're at the point where we can take some questions and have some interaction. So I'd like to be able to capture everybody. So Dan, you had your hand up, and then we're going to go to the back of the room and Steve.
Would you speak a little bit to fees and how to structure fees in a board when boards are hiring? I mean, firms hiring boards.
I think in a private company, I'm opposed to meeting fees because that puts the whole focus exactly where it shouldn't be. It's not about meetings, it's about value. And I think it should be an annual retainer rather than meeting fees.
That's you're shaking your head.
I agree with them.
Oh my God. Now, what should those fees be? It should be in some form of cash and equity, and in the case of a private company, that would be phantom stock or something like that. Certainly, for most of the companies I work with, it's going to be more on the equity, phantom equity, and less on the cash side.
Okay. He agrees, so we'll take
that. No, I don't agree with the last half of his statement. I think phantom stock and privately held companies suggest that the owner is going to sell and doesn't have... We're not tied into the interest of the owner in an owner-manager business, so I don't believe in phantom stock. You have to put the thing in place. It's complicated. They don't understand it, so I'm against that for the kind of company I'm talking about.
Okay.
But all the rest I agree with.
Okay. Yeah.
You both seem satisfied with 1 hour of strategy.
No, I didn't comment on it. So I'm not comfortable with it in any way. One meeting a year is a strategy meeting. Should be, if you're in the process that I've suggested, if you're in the, it's all done, here it is, vote for it, 20 minutes works. You know, they'll do the 16 PowerPoint slides and everybody will raise their hand. But if it's going to be in the prior process all the way through, you need a full time. It's sometimes 2 days because you want the other man, the C-suite people there. I just let it go because we disagree on so much. By the way, and the disagreement is not because he's wrong. We're thinking a lot about different kinds of boards. You work with much larger boards than I'm on. And so Hollis put this group together because what you have is much larger companies, much smaller companies. And they aren't the same. And that's part of this disagreement that Larry and I have always had because we know each other 30 years. So it's not we're disagreeing. It's just different kinds of boards.
And I used an hour. I was just trying to be specific. You know, depending on the nature of the company and the complexity of the company, yeah, that's right. It could be 2 days.
Committed time continuity. That's really what you're talking about. Yes.
Two questions. First one, Larry, you mentioned getting that professional advisors should get onto boards. Can you talk about conflict of interest in terms of if you're an attorney or a service provider, the whole conflict issue? And then second of all, in my experience as crisis counsel, I find that a lot of companies, and particularly CEOs, they think there's a little issue that simmers along, and they think it's going to go away, and therefore they don't bring it to the board's attention. Can you talk about that as well?
You're raising two issues. Let me deal with the second issue first about the crisis. The answer is a lot of this is what are the board dashboards? What is the information that is sent to the board? And sometimes if it's a sophisticated and appropriate dashboard, the board can sense that things are going wrong at a time when the CEO is denying that it's going wrong. But again, the dashboard is going to depend on the sophistication of the company and the ability of the company to put together the information on a timely basis. So again, in the kind of world that Les is dealing with, it may be pretty unsophisticated in terms of crisis management. I don't know. And the second issue about conflicts of interest. Again, I think we are dealing with the difference between boards of directors and boards of advisors. In Les's view, there isn't much of a difference. In my view, big difference. If you are on a board of directors, particularly board of directors of a public company, it's got to be totally squeaky clean. If for no other reason, your reputation. You know, don't go near there if there's going to be a potential conflict of interest. If you're dealing with a private company, and it's a board of directors, my own view is you avoid conflicts with disclosure by putting things on the table and then being really clear about what decisions you're involved in and what decisions you just excuse yourself from and walk out of the room. But the important thing is disclosure and being clear. When you're looking at a board of advisors, I think it would be the same thing. Disclosure, being clear, you know, don't vote, don't even be in the room for certain kinds of decisions that
Less?
I'm okay. I think disclosure is always a critical point. I'm not worried about the conflict point. I'm on the board with many of you. And, you know, I can't imagine for a wholly owned a company owned by the owner-manager that their key advisors are not sitting at that table. Everybody's conflict is pretty out there. You know, the two of you that I've sit on a bunch of boards with, you're lawyers. I mean, you know the client as well as I do. The conflicts are sitting there. But I can't imagine a board without you. Just can't imagine.
In small businesses, a board of directors or a board of advisors
the meetings may be scheduled every 2 months or 4 months or 6 months, but could you speak to the importance of that constant communication between the CEO and board members between meetings?
Well, first of all, anytime you have every 6 months meeting, get off the board. You're useless. You can't help a company every 6 months. 4 months is even too long. My outside acceptable limit is every 3 months, just as a given to the first part. Second, if you're not having the constant communication, you don't have somebody who wants a board. So to me, it's one of those signs where you don't have a CEO who really wants it. To me, what's the point?
I think for me, there are some CEOs who just don't want a board. And then there are the much broader group of CEOs that I work with who just don't know how to manage a board. You know, there's not a course in that at Babson College or Suffolk University. Even Harvard doesn't. I'm sorry.
You used to teach here. You should.
Oh, okay. Most places don't have, most CEOs just don't know how to manage a board. They often learn it through error. And, when you really look at the really sharp CEOs, they know how to communicate with their boards and not just the chairman, and they know who to call, and they usually just call just about everyone in between board meetings. It makes everybody on the board feel that they're important. And that's often a process of trial and error, more error than not.
I did want to make one comment about, since we're getting near the end of the time, and I came with at least one message about what's the role of the board in transactional stuff. So if you don't mind, I'll switch subjects on that. To me, the advisors, the business transaction advisors, whether you're on the board or not, and the board have to play this role together, and I do want to make this comment, which is we all know that if the company doesn't start to prepare itself to sell a year and a half in advance, 2 years in advance, it's not going to be a successful process in general. And so I think, let me just talk to the role of the board. I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an accountant, I'm not an M&A person, so I'm just a director.
I just grabbed my wallet.
No, what I mean is you're professional transaction people. I mean, you have trusted points of view, but you have a function to do. That's all I meant. I'm not one of that. And I'm saying that the role of the board in a transaction company that's going to have a transaction sometime up is to start to lay out what a company needs to look like at the time of the transaction. What's the revenue got to be if you want to get your sale price? What does that look like? What does the dashboard got to look like to drive us to there? Otherwise, we're all setting up frustration. You for spending a lot of time on a transaction that won't happen, and a CEO who's, quote, going to get burnt. And so when you get involved, it should be, if there's a board, making sure the board understands as well as the CEO what's required. What do you need to look like? What do you need to clean up before a transaction actually gets done? So I'm recommending that as many of you get your relationships established with the CEO, you also make contact with the board, or the board should maybe be making contact
input.
With you. Yeah. Input, but also make sure we're all on the same wavelength as to what we need to be at the time of the closing.
Let me, can I make...
So we have 1 minute.
One minute. I'm making it a tape of this conversation. If any of you would like the MP3 file of the conversation, give me your business cards. I'll be glad to send it to you. The second on the transaction, the beginning of the transaction and the end of the transaction. At the beginning of the transaction, one of the roles of the board is to help the CEO be a more effective negotiator, because the party on the other end wants to say, am I talking to a decision maker? Can you say yes or no? Is that going to be the deal? If you've got a board, the CEO can say, well, obviously I'm the CEO and I'm the owner. On the other hand, I do have a board of directors. And that gives you the plausible wiggle room to negotiate something and then sort of try to say, I thought it was a good deal, but my board could come back and And so it gives you a little more wiggle room at the negotiation end. Finally, there's the end of the transaction. How, you know, you're all, there's something in psychology called the attraction-repulsion effect. The further away you are from the goal, the more attractive it is. The closer you are to achieving the end of the goal, the more repulsive it gets. And everybody gets, you know, heebie-jeebies, and they start shaking in their boots. It's part of the role of the board to then reassure the CEO, as we're really getting to the closing of the deal, it's going to be okay. This is going to work.
So a few of the takeaways, unless any of you want to throw some out so we can bring this to closure, a few of the takeaways is to have structure, to make sure strategy is an integral part of the process. It is not a one-time deal. It is a continuum, a process for strategy, that you need to think really clearly about your role serving on the board and hopefully be able to institutionalize for that board of advisors term limits that are rolling limits so that you're getting fresh perspective and you're bringing people in that can really make a difference and it's not all of the same issues being gone over and over and over again. And lastly, depending on what markets your businesses are in, you really need to think about the makeup of the board because I think it was Les that said that one of the board had happened to have been very vertically focused and that ultimately happened to help the value and the sale of the organization. So I think a lot of times what I keep hearing here is that too much diversity doesn't necessarily become helpful for you, but to have some focus and structure and a strategy. And I think that board of advisors ought to have some descriptions. Companies should understand what they're looking for in their board of advisors, what that profile looks like. It's not just a catch-all because somebody is able to come in and influence. So those were some of my takeaways. I don't know if you have any other takeaways. I'm happy to hear them. I want to thank both of you for behaving yourselves so well. It was really a great opportunity to plan with both of them, and I thought it was just a terrific interchange.
Thank,
so thank you both. And I'll